Thank you, Carl. Appreciate the introduction. In the Washington Post article on the conservative elite, Sidney Blumenthal described the Philadelphia Society as a small group of intellectual conservatives who meet regularly to discuss grand philosophy. One can only surmise Mr. Blumenthal has not attended all of our meetings. Public policy has occasionally reared its ugly head. Practical politics has on occasion been mentioned. If in the beginning I err on the side of grand philosophy, I hope to end on a note of practical politics. I wish to help prevent a premature circulation of the conservative elites that he talks about. The purpose of my paper is to discuss political economy south of the border. If not in Texas, at least in Louisiana, we need to know what border we are talking about, and our border is still the Mason-Dixon line. I will therefore leave it to my informed fellow panelists to discuss the particulars of Mexico, Latin America, and South America. I wish to articulate and to defend an older concept of political economy, which interprets it as an art, not a science. Furthermore, I wish to be not simply engaged in normative discourse, a cagey device to allow people to talk about values without affirming anything. But I wish to be openly moralistic. In recent years, there's no question that economists have been more receptive to normative concerns than they used to be. Having lost confidence in the ability of large macroeconometric models to accurately forecast the future, perhaps they've had more time to devote to the ethical aspects of economics. But two things have not changed. The metaphysical assumption of most economists that values are subjective or arbitrary has not really changed. Value relativism still reigns supreme, in the same way that it reigns supreme in the schemes like value clarification, prior to the recent onslaught of Secretary Bennett, who may change all that, we hope. As an example of what political leadership can accomplish, it is conceivable that the Federalist Papers may become a household word. One of my colleagues, John Baker from the LSU Law School, a former University of Dallas product, is currently suing the state of Louisiana for not teaching the Federalist Papers. In a brief moment of civic virtue in Louisiana, the state legislature passed an act mandating the teaching of the Federalist Papers. I'm afraid that the only part of the Federalist Papers that our Louisiana politicians have learned by heart is respect for those darling objects of human avarice. All of my government servants, with the exception of Henson Moore, my Republican congressman, but ardent Republicans must remember that correlation is not causation, are under clouds of suspicion or storms of indictment. My governor, my lieutenant governor, my state superintendent of education, my mayor. The only good that has come out of all this is that the mayor's financial debacle has led him to discover and to solemnly proclaim and promulgate in a public letter to the citizens of Baton Rouge, the virtues of private enterprise and privatization. This is another confirmation of Campbell's law: necessity is the mother of creative financing. The second thing that has not changed is that all economists would subscribe to the dictum of G. Warren Nutter, that to moralize in economics, it is not necessary to be moralistic. Having myself pussy-footed around for many years with the intellectual aspects of the question, let me try to be forthright and radically reactionary. Let me be explicitly moralistic and state that the main purpose of economics is to celebrate and praise the virtue of liberality. Economics should not be restricted to being the science of scarcity, but should take upon itself the art of liberality. This, I think, is a view of economics, or more correctly, political economy, which stems from south of the border. The southern agrarian tradition, however weak it may have been in formulating positive economic theory, had its norms correctly understood. Like Richard Weaver, a follower of the southern agrarians, it understood that the most important thing in a culture are often the least noted. In that gray area between pure freedom and pure coercion, the free market and the state, lies those all-important bellwethers, manners and morals. Because not everything can be reduced to mechanical contract or strict coercion, the Southern view of economics must include rhetoric, friendly persuasion, and leadership based on authority. The bellwether, let us remember, is the male sheep who leads the pack who blindly follow behind. This kind of authority is always being exercised in society, whether for good or for ill. My 13-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, experiences it every day, and in her terminology, it is judging those who are goobs and those who are not. You don't want to live in Goob City. The true end of liberal education is to articulate the good life in order to prepare men to appropriate it in their actions. The art of liberality is an essential part of the good life. The virtue of liberality is the mean between meanness and prodigality. It lies flanked by the vices of avarice and corrupting luxury. Liberality is the economic virtue par excellence because it has to do with wealth. As Aristotle describes it, it has to do with the giving and taking of wealth, and especially respect of giving. He also emphasizes that liberality is concerned with the state of character of the giver, and not simply the external actions as manifested in a multitude of gifts. Political economy in this earlier form was thus connected with the goal of character formation. In contrast, modern economics, agricultural economics, and a fortiori agribusiness, as it's called at Louisiana State University, A&M, have neglected their heritage from the earlier political economy. In their desire to garner the prestige of the physical sciences, they have striven to be value-free and amoral. The state of character is definitely off limits. Instead of the art of choosing ends conducive to the good life and ordering the institutions of everyday life to make men receptive to that good, economics has become a study of how to satisfy most efficiently any set of unexamined desires. First of all, let us think a little bit about the science of scarcity definition, which most classical liberal economists, amongst us, are content to live with. One would think that the radical methodological individualists who are skeptical about so many other aspects of modern economics would have thrown their bombs at this one. I'm afraid to say that it is like the emperor's clothes. There is no social problem of scarcity. There is not such an abstraction as the problem of scarcity. It is precisely a radical individualism, or perhaps better, a radical personalism, that leads me to assert this. Whose wants and desires we are being asked to satisfy, and the status of these wants and desires, has to be examined before it makes sense to try to satisfy them. One has the same problem here for economics as in value clarification schemes. I wish to know whether I'm dealing with a Stalin or a Hitler before I start clarifying values or satisfying somebody's infinite wants. All we have, really, are individual problems of scarcity. I and you claim that we do not have enough of the good things. But to know whether these claims have any grounds for being satisfied, we are each one forced to be philosopher kings. Alas and alack, charity begins at home, and one must start with oneself. Huey Long sure got it wrong empirically when he said every man's a king, but for getting it wrong and for engaging in typically debased Roman forms of liberality, that is, largesse, he was assassinated as a tyrant. In fact, Huey's alleged assassin, Dr. Carl Weiss, was apparently strongly influenced by the murder of Dollfuss in Austria, carried out by the Nazis. We were to have no Louisiana Hitler or Mussolini, even if he did construct highways. One of the great advantages, I think, of an explicitly moralistic approach to the field of economics is that it allows us to discard a certain amount of technical terminology, which is not strictly useful because it is not very clearly defined. In our attempt to be scientific, we have used such awful terms and concepts as externalities, rent-seeking, charity markets, etc. The idea of political economy as concerned with the concept of ways of life and meaningful comparisons between them can once again flower. Constitutional economics, a new movement, for example, should not be conceived only in terms of a contract between utility-maximizing individuals. Whether this thrust comes from the left, a la John Rawls, or from the right, a la public choice, or Segan's economic liberties. A constitution of liberality, in comparison, will force the issues of distributive justice rather than try to skirt them. It will force the issue of a public good as a substantive concept rather than a creation gerrymandered out of private utility. It will place police powers, which ultimately concern character formation, alongside substantive due process, which either enshrines liberty or equality, depending upon your Supreme Court that you choose, as an essential component of the American Federalist tradition. What we think of as economic questions today, the positive and normative questions of price and income determination, were small parts of the police powers of government. These powers were oriented to the well-being of the public, which were promoted by health measures, education, and control of morals. The end of these police powers, the purposes for which they were ultimately invoked, were liberality and civility. William Blackstone has given the classic definition of police powers in his commentaries on the laws of England. He says, by the public police and economy, I mean the due regulation and domestic order of the kingdom, whereby the individuals of the state, like members of a well-governed family, are bound to conform their general behavior to the rules of propriety, good neighborhood, and good manners, and to be decent, industrious, and inoffensive in their respective stations, end quote. Domestic policy not only serves to distinguish the subject matter from foreign policy, but to show that the model of good policy is ultimately the well-run household. The term neighborhood effects is infinitely superior to externalities, which implies that internality and isolation are the ultimate good. What conservatives are really interested in are good households and good neighborhoods. This emphasis on manners in Blackstone signals the fact that no good society wants to rely entirely on coercive laws to bring about peace and harmony. The history of liberality and its relationship to economics still remains to be written, but when it is, there will be chapters on the roots of the term economics in the Greek, Roman, German languages, the history of avarice and luxury in all countries, but specifically Rome and Renaissance Italy. Rome, for example, teaches us that the welfare state, the provider state, of both bread and circuses involves the destruction of both libertas and true liberalitas, by largesse. The recipients of the dole are degraded and debased. As Tiberius, the promoter of old-fashioned austerity, recognized at the time, frugality used to prevail because people had self-control and because we were citizens of one city. Even our domination of Italy did not bring the same temptations, but victories abroad taught us to spend other people's money. Then civil wars showed how to spend our own, end quote. True liberality is being free with one's own, not with that which is taken from others. Conservatives like Andrew Lytle would rather call plunder plunder rather than obfuscate the issue by calling it rent-seeking. Protective tariffs are an example of someone demanding tribute athwart the gates of commerce, not rent-seeking. The history of liberality will also include a major section on the story of the prodigal son. Besides numerous prints and paintings of the episodes from Durer to Rembrandt, there are other visual sources to stimulate the imagination, such as Bruegel's The Fight Between Carnival and Lent, Hogarth's Beer Street and Gin Lane, The Idle and Industrious Apprentice. Now, how does all this tie in with forestalling the premature circulation of the conservative elites? As Blumenthal noted in his Washington Post article, the movement conservatives are wary, if not downright hostile, to the non-ideological Republicans, many of whom are businessmen. Now, many businessmen are reached and also tapped by movement conservatives, but not enough, and certainly not those who are the leaders of business, either nationally or in most local communities. If the movement conservatives hope to survive the demise of Reagan, they're going to have to do more than engage in credentialing, as important as that is. They are going to have to network into the business community and culture. This, I think, cannot be done on a rhetoric simply of self-interest or privatization. Those who argue for protective tariffs, trading with the enemy, being cozy with the regulators, are all perfectly familiar with self-interest categories. The appeal is going to have to be made on broader cultural grounds. The concept of self-interest, whatever its ultimate source, has a suspicious beginning, derived or filtered down from the reason of state literature, the Machiavellian assault on a political science grounded on self-government. Since self-government was chancy and never guaranteed, it had to be replaced by more predictable patterns, which were based on interest. Both social outcomes and, even more frightening, men were to be manipulated for utilitarian purposes. If all interests then, self, group, party, or nation, are equally power grabs, which are amoral, then one has no base on which to condemn rent-seeking, big government, coercive union powers, etc. The art of political economy is founded on liberality, makes possible then an apertura a centro, an opening to the non-movement Republican and businessman center, which is not going to listen to appeal to arguments based on narrow self-interest. It is conceivable that they can be appealed to by arguments of charity, private and corporate liberality, and civic responsibility. But here, if I may take a page from the prodigal son story, the movement conservatives should quit playing the elder son role to their younger brother, the neoconservatives. It is precisely the neoconservatives like Crystal, Novak, and Gilder, who is ambiguous on whether he's a neoconservative or a straight conservative, are the men who are asserting the religious and moral roots of the bourgeois order. Novak's indictment of the aristocratic and honor-loving economics, or rather anti-economics, of the Spanish style certainly goes a long way in explaining the relative underdevelopment in Latin America, the drag of the pensadores. The alternative Catholic tradition, the tradition of the scholastics, if not libertarian, is certainly compatible with free markets and the promotion of virtue. The failure of movement conservatives has been to not pick up this heritage, to not fuse virtue, the bourgeois order, which presupposes virtue in the individual, family, and the culture, and the free market. But coming closer to our own time, it is interesting that hardly anyone has noticed the similarity of Novak's work to that of Wilhelm Röpke, not even Novak himself. Röpke's work is still the best in articulating that bourgeois order which requires both free markets and human virtue. In conclusion, we have the option of remaining pure and talking to ourselves, or extending our horizons beyond the narrowly economic and political in order to liberally educate both ourselves and the non-ideological heartland, whose support may be necessary for the preservation of that conservative elite. Thank you.
Very interesting start. The moral principles with Dr. Campbell is discussing do have to be applied to the real world. One of the most painful and morally ambiguous questions with which we are now dealing is that of immigration policy. It's awkward in both an ethical and an economic way. Are police powers used rightly? Mexico is, after all, our neighbor, as are many other countries whose citizens desire to become Americans.